Hello, welcome to Press TV News Analysis. I'm Kavit Afwai. 0600 a.m. Syrian time. All appeared quiet in Syria. UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan's ceasefire deal seemed to have worked. Hours later, two incidents of violence, one officer dead, 24 others injured, with a number of law enforcement officers injured in another incident blamed on an armed terrorist groups with explosive devices. The Assad government has time and again blamed these groups for being part of the problem. Groups armed by some Arab countries, like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, with financial support from both Arab and Western countries, like the U.S. and France. In this news analysis, we'll discuss the situation in Syria, plus reactions to the fragile ceasefire, such as Russia, the U.K., the United States, and China.
Calm makes a tentative return to Syria. Reports coming out of the country suggest that a ceasefire brokered by the UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan is holding, with no major violations from the government forces and the armed groups. The ceasefire came into effect early on Thursday. The foreign-backed opposition has confirmed that the situation is calm across Syria.
Till this moment, the Syrian regime abide the ceasefire. Started today at 6 a.m. Local time, and there is no major violence report.
Damascus has, however, warned it will return fire if attacked by the armed groups. Meanwhile, the truce has drawn reactions from the veto-holding members of the UN Security Council, Russia, China, and Britain. Russia's foreign minister has called for time for Annan's peace plan to work. Sergei Lavrov criticized some Arab and Western states for dismissing the peace plan as a failure even before it went into effect. He called on the Arab and Western countries to use their influence with the armed groups to avoid future unrest. China also welcomed the ceasefire in Syria, urging the armed groups to honor the truce.
It's an important step that Syria has taken towards political resolution, and it's a sign that Annan's mediation efforts has achieved important progress. China also hopes all sides in Syria to immediately cease fire and implement Annan's six-point proposal.
However, the British Prime Minister has openly criticized the Annan peace plan. David Cameron expressed, quote, immense frustration over global support for the peace plan. Cameron called for tightening of the noose on Damascus. Parts of Syria have been ravaged by year-long unrest. The Syrian opposition blames the unrest on Damascus, but the government says it's the work of what it calls terrorists funded and armed by foreign countries.
Well, let me introduce our guest to get this going. From the Syrian Social Club, Amar Waqaf joins us from London. From the Executive Intelligence Review, Jeff Steinberg joins us from Washington. And Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy, Robert Naiman, joins us via Skype from Urbana, Illinois. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first go to you, Amar Waqaf. How would you describe the ceasefire, as fragile as it may be for the time being? Will it hold?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there are certain stakeholders who may very well be interested in, breaking up this ceasefire. There are countries in the region that have voted and pledged basically to continue arming the opposition. And this obviously flies in the face of this entire peace plan. There are also issues with regards to the opposition fabrication themselves. These are not coherent groups. These are groups that do not follow a certain command structure. So even if their leaderships or supposed leaderships say that they're going to follow or they're going to commit to the peace plan, that doesn't mean at all that the troopers on the ground or the militants on the ground would actually adhere to this. So we're not so sure that from the position of the militants that they would actually adhere to this. And the Syrian army can retaliate at any moment, obviously.
Well, when you say that they're not going to adhere to this, and you talked about some of the countries behind this, I'd like you to mention who those countries are. Well, what's going to happen when those UN monitors are going to be sent into Syria, which there's been an agreement on that, and they notice what is going on, then what?
Well, the countries are no secret to anyone. It's Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. These are the countries that publicly vote and pledged and voiced out their interest, really, in arming the opposition and so on and so forth. And the Syrian government, when they asked for certain guarantees, they did specifically name these three countries. With regards to the monitors, I think they're based on the hope that this peace, ceasefire is going to hold. And if that does happen, then probably they can find themselves in a place where they're actually monitoring who's attacking who. But if we think within the logic of these countries who are very much bent on changing the regime in Syria and have got nothing to do with the interests of the Syrian people, in my own opinion, obviously, then probably they would want this peace plan to collapse. So let's just see how it goes.
Well, let's look at some of the reactions. Jeff Steinberg, Damascus said it reserves the right to respond in kind to any possible attack by armed groups. Russia, more time needed. It accused some Arab and Western countries of dismissing Anan's plans as a failure. China welcomed the ceasefire, urged armed groups to honor the truce. And then we have the UK. It slammed the initiative as frustrating, with the U.S. pessimistic at best in terms of how they viewed it. It's almost as if the U.S. and the UK, in a way, don't want the ceasefire to work.
I think that's absolutely the case. I see an absolute continuity here from the time of the invasion and overthrow of Saddam Hussein back in 2003 through the overthrow and assassination while in custody of Gaddafi last year, and now on to the situation in Syria. In all of those instances, we've seen the British take a very strong point in support of absolute regime change. Remember the whole scandal around the sexed up Downing Street dossier, the white paper that was used as one of the chief propaganda drives for the Iraq War. There was clearly a decision led by Britain and France that Gaddafi had to go. I think it had a lot to do with successful inroads that China was developing throughout the African continent, with Gaddafi as a kind of a key figure in that. And now all of these governments are on the record as saying that the only acceptable outcome in Syria is the removal of Assad. And so they're carrying out an armed illegal invasion. They're financing a Contra or Mujahideen type surrogate army to overthrow the regime. And this time around, Russia and China said absolutely not. Russia and China were lied to and basically manipulated into abstaining from the UN Security Council resolution that led to the overthrow militarily by foreign forces of Gaddafi in Libya. And they've just simply said, we are not going to do it again. Russia has strategic interests in Syria that are very well known, from the Mediterranean port access at Tartus to economic and military ties. And for the Chinese, the concept of humanitarian interventionism, the new buzzword is responsibility to protect. These ideas represent a much broader fundamental assault against national sovereignty. And so they are opposed on very principled grounds. So you have a fault line internationally. And I think it should be obvious to some of the hothead nations that are pushing this conflict to the edge that they could be mucking around with a much bigger war than simply a limited regime change operation in Syria.
Right.
This is very reminiscent, and the Russians have warned, this is like Europe before the Sarajevo incident that triggered World War I.
It was a historical veto, wasn't it, by Russia and China. Robert Naiman, and let's get it into that more after I get your reaction, which is perhaps one of the most interesting reactions, and it was the onus is on Syria to keep the government's promise and hold to a ceasefire. Now, why would the UN chief Ban Ki-moon, who said this, why would he say this? I mean, doesn't it in a way clearly show whose side he's on?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think Kofi Annan deserves a lot of credit for having helped lead the world to this point, despite the resistance from many sides, as was noted. the bad mouthing of his diplomatic efforts by some in the West, for example. The Hamas plan isn't just a ceasefire. It does also call for the pullback of Syrian forces from the city. So it hasn't yet been fully implemented. And I think that's what he's calling attention to. And the fact that the Syrian military hasn't pulled back does represent a danger, because this is something that could be used as an excuse on the other side by armed groups to violate the ceasefire, saying, well, the Syrian government's not complying, so we don't have to comply. So the situation is still dangerous, and I think it's definitely, you know, those who don't want to see another war, which would be devastating to people of Syria, I mean, you know, in this case, escalation of the war, but also a region war, devastating people in the region, should want to see the plan fulfilled. I think the fact that diplomatic efforts have been able to bring us to this point show what serious diplomatic and Chinese said balanced diplomatic efforts can achieve despite the bad mouthing. So this moment should be seized upon to try to deepen the implementation, try to get the monitors in. I think that's very important, because of course there's going to be some violations of the agreement on both sides. When that happens, you want to have independent observers on the ground who can say who did what, so that pressure and shaming can be brought to bear on the parties that can put that to a stop. And that means not just actors inside the country, but actors outside the country. The fact that the West, and particularly the three countries that I mentioned, Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, the fact that they've been backing the armed opposition, that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, yes, as pointed out, that's a violation of Syria's sovereignty. On the other hand, it's a pressure point, because it means that there's an address. If there are violations of the ceasefire on the opposition side, then that can be presented to Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the West, and saying, you know, as the Russians pointed out, you know, just as Russia and China and Iran have responsibilities with respect to the Syrian government, so too Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey and the West have responsibilities with respect to the opposition. So it's very important that pressure remain on all sides to comply with the ceasefire, comply with the accord, allow the monitors in, allow there to be independent reporting of who's doing what in order to maintain the peace and maintain the space for a political and diplomatic resolution of the conflict.
Okay, well, Amar Awagaf, when I asked you the first question, I got the feeling that it's an uphill battle, since you have all these countries, UN countries, aside from China and Russia, they're all united in a sense for this not to work indirectly. I'm not saying they want deaths, but for this ceasefire not to work. I mean, we're looking at two instances already violated by these armed groups in which there were officials. Two violations occurred where a Syrian government official was killed, along with military personnel, one officer dead, 24 others injured. This kind of goes beyond Syria, in a sense, doesn't it? Because do you think that the tables are now turning gradually? The media is softening a little bit. Even The Guardian reported these to be armed terrorist groups. So may we see divisions within the UN all of a sudden start appearing, cracks perhaps, where all the countries are now realizing that what Assad is saying is indeed true, especially if these monitors come in the ground, and therefore will then that lead to maybe divisions by the countries who are now united against Syria, who want Assad to leave, maybe backtrack a little bit on their views towards what is happening on the ground?
Indeed. I mean, we've seen the first signs of this in the presidential statement of the Security Council, UN Security Council, a few weeks back, or 3 weeks back in itself. That statement in itself is actually backing down from certain, you know, high-level demands that the international community or the West had actually demanded from Syria, you know, the stepping down of President Bashar al-Assad, you know, all sorts of issues. But then they've gone back a little bit. I think the Western countries in general have realized that President Bashar al-Assad and his government command a certain critical mass of Syrian population approval with regard, in order to keep going on and on and on. So it's going to be very hard for them to stick to their original objective of toppling up the regime. Now, this message is yet to be convinced, actually the other parties like the Saudis, the Qataris and the Turks, because these three countries have actually, you know, crossed the line of low return very early on with their propaganda, with arming these rebels and, with making a lot of pressure. So there is a rift between what the expectations, what the Western countries believe to be as realistic expectations of these of this conflict as an outcome, and what the Gulf states and Turkey believe should be, which is the full toppling of the regime. So this is the crack that we're seeing. And actually, it was interesting today to hear UN Secretary General saying that all countries of the world should actually work together to make this work. And, you know, at the face of it, they might think that this is, you know, meaning Russia and meaning China. But actually, if you go deep into it, it may well be those countries who are refusing, they are still in a state of denial about the real position of the Syrian government. And they believe that, you know, if international pressure mounts more, then the Syrian government is going to collapse. So, so in a sense, yes, there are cracks. And I think we're starting to go towards the sort of solution. It's going to take time, in my opinion. And as you have rightly said, we've seen some incidents today. And I think this proves that, that the opposition is really fragmented. And I'm not going to say they're not really committed to the ceasefire, but what I'm going to say is that there are certain groups on the ground who do not really follow this hierarchy, which makes it even more complicated. So what we're hoping for is that this would carry on. Hopefully, I'm not very optimistic, to be honest, but I'm hoping that it would carry on. And if that is the case, then probably the Western states could tell the Gulf states and Turkey, look, guys, you know, this is a way out. Let's just lower our expectations a little bit and see how we can be a little bit more constructive.
Unless we look at a situation, Jeff Steinberg, in terms of how the U.S., for example, has reacted to what's going on in Bahrain, how they reacted to what went on in Yemen. Analyze that for us, because on paper, obviously, they have different ideas about how all these revolutions should occur in terms of shaping it towards their political objectives. Put that into perspective for us, Jeff Steinberg, if you can.
Well, you know, General Wesley Clark wrote a book a couple of years ago, and he's been interviewed a dozen times in the recent months, and he recounted a conversation that he had with one of the leading U.S. neoconservatives, Paul Wolfowitz, back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And Wolfowitz said to him, we have a span of about 20 years window before some other major world power emerges to challenge the United States. And in that 20-year period, there's a whole list of regimes that are going to be changed. And he ticked off a list of 6 or 7 or 8 countries, which obviously included Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Somalia. And he just said, all of these countries, we have a period of time, and every one of these governments, they sided with the Soviets during the Cold War. We're going to get rid of all of them. And, you know, what I think is very important to bear in mind, I agree with what the speaker just said about the fault lines and things, but I think it's very important to realize that there were some lessons learned after Libya. We had the Russia-China veto. They're not going to give ground for a United Nations Security Council resolution to be interpreted as a green light for regime change. The Syrian government realized that the strategy that was targeting them was identical to the strategy that overthrew Gaddafi. They wanted to create a Benghazi-type liberated zone on Syrian territory. And so you had 3 areas heavily targeted militarily by the Syrian government. You had Homs, which was a short distance from the Lebanese border. You had Idlib in the north near the Turkish border, and the Daraa area down in the south near Jordan. They cut off the prospect of creating liberated zones that would be maybe called humanitarian corridors, but would be areas where an alternative government could be installed on Syrian territory, recognized by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the US, France, Britain, and it's a whole different ballgame. So militarily, the Western alliance, along with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, suffered a substantial military defeat. And so I look at this less as fault lines emerging, as I see it as a regroupment, because they suffered a major military defeat in what's fundamentally a military regime change operation. So I think that the Russia-China actions have set it back substantially, because the Russians and Chinese see a danger of a much larger war. And for the Russians, it's a war that's not very far from their borders. You can't separate the Syria situation from the Iran situation and now the North Korea situation. You've got a global eruption of provoked confrontations that could get very easily out of control, and you have a world war situation rather than seemingly targeted and limited regime change
right.
operations. So,
I'd like to come in here since we're quickly running out of time. Yeah. Robert Nayman, we need to, I've said this time and again, what Russia and the foreign minister of Russia said was very revealing, signaling to the West and some of these Arab countries, even if you arm the opposition to the teeth, they will not be able to defeat the Syrian army, and there's going to be bloodshed to come for years. So are we looking at a situation that the foreign minister would hate to see unfold?
Well, that's one path. I think that path can be prevented, and I think that Anand's plan is the path that to be pursued to present that. So, nobody can predict, but there's a path that's been opened, and if the parties are held to account for that path, then I think that carnage can be avoided. It's not only Russia and China that took lessons from what happened in the past. Many people in Syria took lessons from what happened in the past. And they saw what happened in Iraq, for example, and don't want to see that happen in their own country. So I think there is still space for different paths to happen. But it's very important to have tools like the independent observers so that the people around the world can have a relatively unbiased source of information about what's happening. And so actors that are trying to violate ceasefires, trying to put us back on a path to conflict and war, those actors can be exposed and shamed. And that's absolutely crucial.
And Ammar Wahab, my last question to you is going to be, where do you see this going? We've seen the positive steps that the Assad government has taken. As a matter of fact, they asked some of the armed groups and its members, whether they're the former people of the army, for example, if they don't have blood on their hands, to come forward, and they will set them free to introduce themselves. In addition to the reforms, in addition to the elections taking place and a host of other efforts, do you foresee a political resolve coming onto the horizon, as some are predicting?
I think it's going to take some time, actually.
How much time?
Those people.
Give us a time frame, in your opinion.
I think months, really. But I think it would all go down to how the international community really behaves. So, for example, in Bahrain, we are seeing the international community at the moment sweeping all the problems under the carpet and saying, well, let's have this Grand Prix, Formula One. And, let's pretend that nothing is going on out there. So, in a sense, we don't want that in Syria. We know there are problems in Syria. We want the international community to incubate, instead of inflame the opposition, to incubate the opposition and start cooling their nerves down and tell them, you need to realize that the government isn't really going anywhere and you need to sit down with them. Because there are a lot of people who are afraid. Those who fled the country have been fed with information that if the Syrian army catches you, they're going to slaughter you all, which is obviously not correct. But,
I got to jump in here. Unfortunately, we're out of time. From the Syrian Social Club, you were just listening to Ammar Wahab from London, from the Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you so much. Jeff Steinberg from Washington, the Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy, Robert Nayman from Urbana, Illinois. And thank you, the viewer, for watching. another edition of the Press TV News Analysis. I'm Kavitha Arbaye, and from the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.